joining today, and thank you for tuning in. I'm Dr. Lara Garibe, a research fellow here at the University of Ottawa Heart Institute. I'm your host for today's episode of Beats Research Radio, a YouTube channel and podcast produced by the Bioengineering and Therapeutic Solutions Lab at the Ottawa Heart Institute. Our goal at Beats Research Radio is to communicate science to the community. Our guest today is Dr. Giovanni Ferrari. Dr. Ferrari is a graduate from the University of Pavia in Lombardy, Italy. After his PhD, he conducted his postdoctoral fellowship at New York University, after which he was hired as an assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania. In 2017, he was recruited by Columbia University, where he started his full program and is now an associate professor in the Department of Surgery and School of Biomedical Engineering. Dr. Ferrari is the scientific director of the Cardiothoracic Research Program and director of the Columbia Biobank for Translational Science. His main research interests are in heart valve and vascular cell physiology, cardiac mechanobiology, materials science and medical devices, and the brain-heart axis. We at Beats Research Radio are delighted to host Dr. Ferrari today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Lara.
So Dr. Ferrari, can you start by telling us in lay terms, what exactly is translational science research? And maybe share with us some of the translational projects that are currently undergoing in your lab.
Sure. So translational research is actually not a separate arm of research, a separate area. It's actually, at least in my opinion, a tool that scientists like me can use to bridge clinical science, a particular clinical problem, and link it to the underlying molecular and cellular biology that are characterizing the disease. So this is a tool that needs, like every tool that needs to be learned, that needs to be improved, and then can be very effective in translating our clinical knowledge towards basic science. This is a program that we have been doing for almost 20 years now, as you said, first at NYU, then at Penn, and now in full bloom at Columbia. And what we're really trying to do is to gather as much knowledge as possible from the clinical activity of our cardiac surgery program in particular. This is the area that I cover. And then utilize the our basic science, like cellular and molecular biology, to really try to bridge the two fields and try to provide a new light to understanding the clinical problem. We are covering a very broad range of disease in our lab. There are four main thematic areas. One is heart valve disease. Another one is heart attack and myocardial infarction. A third one is implanted medical devices. And then the most recent one is heart transplant. Those are the areas that we are actually working on. We've been working on for the past 10 years.
Okay, very interesting. And as I mentioned earlier, you are also the director of the Columbia Biobank for Translational Science. In lay terms again, can you provide an explanation of what a biobank is and how it plays an essential part in translational research?
Certainly. So you and I have been trained as basic scientists, and at the core of our training is scientific reductionism, which is the idea to make a very complex problem a little bit simpler in order to make it accessible in order for us to study. Mm-hmm. An example of scientific reduction is when you are utilizing an animal model, for example, which is easier to manipulate, which is easier to understand, and is more reproducible because it's lacking many of the confounding variables that we do actually see in clinic. Obviously, mm-hmm. In heart disease, in a murine model, is not the same thing as an heart disease in the patient in the human population. So in order to try, but we're now moving in a new different direction, which is the one to try to understand the clinical problem from a more personalized and what we call precision medicine point of view, which is the effort to understand how the variability, the intravariability between all of the patients are impacting the diseases we are studying. In order to do that, we need to access clinical data, but also biological specimen. And that's where the biobank that I've been directing for the past few years play a role. We are collecting all the clinical information of the patients enrolled in our program. We are analyzing their imaging analysis. We have blood from that we are collecting from this patient. We are collecting DNA like many other biobank. But what makes our biobank unique is that we are within the Department of Surgery. And every time you intervene surgically in a patient, obviously you are trying to preserve as much as possible the native cardiac structure and not to alter the natural anatomy and physiology of the cardiac structure. But there are situations where tissue needs to be removed as part of the regular clinical course. And this is true for surgical oncology or with the resection of the tumor, or even in cardiac surgery when you have to repair a valve that is no longer functioning. These resected tissue are collected by my clinical coordinator and by my team upon an informed consent and in the approved IRB protocol. And what do? With this tissue, we are conducting basic and cellular molecular study to really try to understand not only what the cardiac structure is, but also how different it is among different patients that are developing the same type of disease. And this is very important because while the endpoint can be similar, the disease development could be different in different subgroup of patients. And logically, when you're trying to develop a therapy to address a particular disease, a one-size-fits-all therapy might not be the most effective way of conducting this intervention. But rather, we are trying to risk stratify the patient for the risk of developing one disease or another and try to target our therapy in a way that is more effective for a particular group of patients and maybe less for another, in which we do have to, you know, add maybe another type of intervention. That's why it's important to create this biobank, to continue accessing and expanding our biobank, and to try really to match the diversity of our population. We are lucky enough, obviously, in New York, we have a very diverse population, and our biobank is reflecting that. And this is a fantastic tool because we can really learn of all the differences that make us unique individual, but also they make us uniquely susceptible to different type of disease. That's why it's important to have this biobank.
Exactly. And as you mentioned, the importance of it is the animal models will have some limitations sometime for us to translate into the clinic later. So having these tissues in the biobank will help further understand and move things from the bench to the bedside.
That's correct. We are using this animal model, but as just one of the tools that we have at our disposal. And to this, what makes our program is really a multidisciplinary approach. We are tackling the same problem from different angles, including the analysis of human collected specimen.
Exactly. So I'm going to switch gears a little bit now and talk about the Columbia University Irving Medical Center program for residents to be trained in research. I would love for you to explain your program's unique approach of training residents to become more involved in translational research, and what are some of the advantages for going through that path, and maybe share some of the challenges.
Sure, certainly. This is a very important point for us as a surgical group and as a medical center. The training of our surgeons is absolutely pillar, a foundation for our program. And we are really investing a lot, and we are really proud of the achievement that the type of surgeons they are that we are producing at Columbia. Mm-hmm. There are many amazing surgical programs in the United States, in North America, throughout the world. But they are historically mostly oriented towards making good physicians, which is obviously also one of our priorities. Mm-hmm. But today, this is no longer enough to really create the next generation of physicians. So Columbia has a unique division within the Department of Surgery, which is the Division of Surgical Science, and I am part of the leadership of this division. This is a division that is clearly embedded into our department. We have strong voice within our department, and we are sharing the curricula for training our residents. What we are trying to achieve is to train the next generation of surgeons to have a broader view that include the basic science, the molecular understanding, the scientific rigor, and the really deep knowledge of all the mechanisms, not just the clinical implication, but also the mechanobiology, biomechanics, basic science, all the other different components they might be then used to have a better understanding of the diagnosis of a patient, and maybe to better intervene or to participate in developing new therapies. So we have a training program. We are presenting the training program directly during the interview process. Our residents are usually very eager to take some time off. It's an additional 1 or 2 years of training. It's not a small addition to their already very long and demanding training. Usually we are adding 1 or 2 years of training at the end of the third year of residency. They come to the lab, they are assigned a project, and they work alongside with one of our PhD or basic scientists. Mm-hmm. And this is really where the value of the program is, because they are bringing their deep knowledge of the clinical setting, and they are absorbing from our basic science and basic scientists the molecular biology, the underlying science of the disease they are seeing every day in clinic and in the operation room. This makes the broader horizon, the broader understanding. And overall, we think they make them a better surgeon. So we are very proud of that program. We are making every effort to keep expanding it. And we had a very good return. We have a lot of residents that are actually choosing Columbia because of this intensive research program that we are offering. Challenges. Challenges is certainly learning a new language. And this is true for both sides. For example, we are both studying the same cardiac disease, but mm-hmm. one group of people, the surgeon, they are seeing the problem from the clinical and outcome perspective. Whereas maybe the molecular biologists see this more in terms of like protein or gene or pharmacotherapy. So building the bridges between these two is incredibly important. And you can only do when you're working side by side. And that's why each of our research projects has MDs and PhD working alongside and sharing ideas all day long. And I think this is really fostering a culture of communication, interdependence. And at the end of the day, the sum of the two entities is bigger than the sum of the individual one. So we think that while this could be a little challenging for all parties involved, the results are really outstanding. And I think we have achieved some nice outcome in this setting for the past few years.
That's very nice. And hopefully any residents that are listening to this interview would be probably interested in learning more about this program. So you can reach out to Dr. Ferrari to learn a bit more about it.
And we have a brand new website that they can look. So they can look for us.
We'll make sure to include your website.
Thank you.
So one of the areas of interest in your research portfolio is focused on investigating the uses of implantable devices and their structural degeneration. The goal of this research is to develop novel device biomaterials with enhanced properties. So can you share with us a recent example of this area of interest from your group?
Of course, we are very excited about this biomedical engineering component of our program. So when a surgeon are, for example, repairing a valve or repairing or working on the myocardium, the first choice is always to preserve the patient native tissue. There are several reasons to do that, and we want to be as less invasive as possible during our cardiac surgery procedure. Unfortunately, there are situations where the native tissue is no longer viable or is no longer functional, such in the case of aortic valve replacement. In this case, what we do, we implant a valve that can be a mechanical valve or most likely a prosthetic valve made of biomaterial that has been treated chemically and then can mimic the performances of the native valve. these type of valves that are implanted very successfully and they are very resistant and resilient, they have, however, a limit in terms of durability. The large majority of the patients that are receiving these medical devices are already elderly patients. And if we are offering a device that is lasting 10, 15 years, it's reasonable to assume that this will cover most of the remaining life expectancy. However, there are unfortunately several groups of patients that are in need of receiving these medical devices at a younger age. And the younger age could be adult, could be young adult, could be pediatric, and unfortunately can also be infant. Unfortunately, the durability of these devices seems to be inversely proportional to the age of implant, meaning that the device will last less when the patient is young. And so we really need to improve on the durability of these medical devices. So our research group has undertaken the challenge to try to understand the mechanism of failure of this implantable biomaterial, and two, to modify them and really try to make them more durable, in particular for a subgroup of patients. As I was mentioned before, we need to try to customize our research for the individual risk factor for each of these patients, group of patients. So what we have recently discovered is a previously unreported mechanism that is driving the failure of this implantable biomaterial. And this is the result of an interaction between the blood biochemistry of the patients with the material. Having learned that with the support of the National Institute of Health over the past 5 years, we have now developed a chemical treatment of the biomaterial that can be implemented on almost all the implantable biomaterial currently in the market that can be added to the biomaterial and make them more resistant to this newly discovered mechanism driving the degeneration of the tissue. So we have recently published a month ago, I think more or less came out on the scientific database, we deposited there, a new chemical modification of implantable biomaterial that allow this material to be more resistant. And we think that that could be applicable to high-risk patients group, such as pediatric or young adult, or maybe diabetic patients. These two groups are, in our opinion, probably the primary target for our technology, but we hope that this could be applied to almost all implantable devices, because at the end of the day, most of these implants are exposed either to systemic circulation or to any fluids once they are implanted in the patient. And so providing a material which is more resistant to degeneration could have a lot of significant implication for many type of surgical intervention, not exclusively cardiac. And we are still working on that, but we already achieve, I think, a good level of knowledge in this field.
We're looking forward to following the research that you guys are doing. So before we conclude our interview, I would like to tackle one more part of your career focuses, which is mentorship. You have been involved in multiple professional committees and societies that target early career professionals. Can you tell us what your view is with regards to steps needed for early career advancement?
Absolutely. So as an educator, this is particularly important for me. I have a large group. I have a very diverse group of students from different disciplines, coming from different parts of the world. And it is very important that we are continue this effort to educate the next generation of scientists on one end and surgeons on the other. So in order to do that, as you mentioned, I joined several societies with the scope of promoting early education and try to help the next generation of scientists. This is a particularly challenging time. I think scientific education needs to be continuously promoted. And on that, I want to thank you and your radio for all the efforts in this. I think what we have seen over the past couple of years is showing that we really need to support science, we need to promote science, and we need to make people understand the significance of believing in science and the reality that science could make our life better. In terms of career development, as I mentioned for our scientific approach, early career development also need to be tailored around the individual. It is very, very important that each early stage scientist, each student interested in research and science, creates a group of individuals at mid and senior level that can advise them around their own individual interest, goal, and career aspiration. There is, as there are not really a one size fit all. There are obviously general things that are very important, which is create a network, writing and working and doing good science, of course, be open to collaboration, be open to accept rejection. As a scientist, you will face a lot of setback and rejection. It's just part of the of our job. But really try to, when your interests evolve, when the interest of an early career scientist evolve, so show the network of support that you have around you. Mm-hmm. Expand it, try to identify people that can really help you to develop your goal. And I think that's really important, because you need to have passion on what you want to do, but you need to have support. Mm-hmm. And you also have to be a little bit of luck. This is certainly true in any aspect of life, and certainly it's true in science. And I think the other thing is that foster your own curiosity. I think the risk here is that follow a standard path of career development. And I think we really need a new direction. We need new initiative. We need people that are able to connect the dot from different picture and create something really new. This is where the real intellectual energy is needed. This is where really I want to hire new early stage investigators that are really bringing something new to my team. They are bringing new to the division. They are bringing something new. This is where we really want to invest in motivated people and really people that are willing to expand their horizon of knowledge. That's very important for me when I look for new candidate and new students.
Mm-hmm. Well, this concludes our interview. Once again, I'd like to thank our guest for this episode, Dr. Giovanni Ferrari, for the informative and fascinating talk with us regarding his unique research program. Thank you, Dr. Ferrari. It was a pleasure having you.
Thank you, Lara.
And on behalf of the whole Beats Research Radio team, thank you all for tuning in. And don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube Beats Research Radio and podcast channels. And we'll see you again with another Science for the Community episode. Until then, stay safe.